reading this morning continues our studies in the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. And we read in chapter 5 and from verse 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and from verse 8. If you see the poor oppressed in a district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son there is nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain, since he toils for the wind? All his days he eats in darkness, with great frustration, affliction, and anger. Then I realized that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given him, for this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. Amen, and may God add his public blessing to this. Now turn with me, please, to that passage that we read together earlier in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 5. I wonder, do you ever dream about being someone else? Have you ever thought, if only I was in so-and-so's shoes, my life would be better, it would be richer, it would be fuller, it would be far more satisfying? Have you ever thought, it would be great to be fabulously rich, so that you might find an echo in your heart to the words of the song, "Money, money, money in a rich man's world." What is it that religiously drives men and women to fill out their football pool coupon? Why is it that the proposal of a national lottery has excited so many people? In great measure, it is because so many people are persuaded that if only they had enough money, their problems would disappear overnight. And they would discover that elusive satisfaction that they'd been pursuing all their lives. Well, the writer of Ecclesiastes has been demolishing the false notions which men and women have about how to get the best out of life. And in the passage before us, he explodes the myth that has burrowed its way deep into contemporary society, namely that happiness is linked, index linked, to the size of your bank balance. Notice that the preacher begins in verses 8 and 9 by pointing to the social implications of the myth that wealth is the source of happiness. He reasons that poverty and oppression are the product of the grasping hand of those in power and authority. Where this exists, there will never be benevolent rule, but a social structure in which people are determined to line their own pockets at the expense of justice. He describes here the predatory nature of a bureaucracy where each man eyes those immediately below him, and he works out how much of his junior's ill-gotten gains and bribes he will be able to cream off for himself. We don't have to look very far to see the ways in which people have used their position to increase their own personal wealth. The counselor who takes a bribe to ensure that a contract is awarded to a certain firm or that planning permission is given to another. Think of the foreign holidays, the bribes and the sweeteners and the under-the-table payments which are offered and received. This is increasingly reshaping our own society. Why is that? Because men and women have bought the myth that increased wealth brings increased happiness. And in order to undermine that myth, we find the preacher here makes some startling observations. First of all, in verse 10, he shows that the philosophy of the grasping hand increases a person's appetite, but not his satisfaction. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. You see, when a man becomes captivated by a love for wealth, there is born within his heart a lust and a craving which can never be satisfied. There is an addiction here which is as deadly as that of crack or cocaine. For the man who loves wealth never has enough of it. The story is told of one of the Rockefellers once asked which million he most enjoyed making. And he replied, "Oh, it's always the next one." He never had enough. Such a man is persuaded that his life consists in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Now that in turn creates a society of opportunists with an eye for the main chance. And as a result of that, a serious dehumanizing process begins. You see, the very best things in human personality are destroyed increasingly. Man is gradually reduced to a money-making robot. And he is perplexed by the fact that his rising bank balance is not matched by a rising sense of satisfaction. It's with good reason that the psalmist wrote, "Though your riches increase, do not set your heart upon them." Secondly, the preacher demonstrates in verse 11 that wealth has the ability to increase your dependence without increasing your income. Wealth can be a dubious blessing, for it produces a whole host of hangers-on. Read some of the biographies of those who have won millions in the pools. Invariably what happens is this. Within the matter of a few days of their win being made public, they discover that they have a whole army of second cousins and best friends of their parents that they've never met before in all their life. And the other interesting thing is that all of these people just so happen to have a financial problem that they need help with. Hangers-on. Then there are those who seek to worm their way into the company of the wealthy, fawningly ingratiating themselves in the hope that they might join the gravy train. Hangers on. Isaiah describes this effect very graphically in Isaiah chapter 22, verses 20 to 25, where he warns a court official that high office may involve him in relationships which would cause him to collapse. He says, "At first you may appear to be a peg that is firmly driven into the wall. But once all the hangers-on have come and put their weight upon you, what happens? That peg which appears to be in a secure place is pulled out of the wall." Michael Caine, the actor, in an interview described the nauseating pretense of Hollywood society, where people spend a great deal of their time dropping hints in order that they might be invited to the right kind of parties. Why? In order to join that particular individual's gravy train. That illustrates what the preacher says here. If you are wealthy, you're likely to collect around you a group of hangers-on who contribute absolutely nothing to you, but cost you a lot. Thirdly, we learn from verse 12 that wealth increases your insomnia, but not your contentment. The laborer is able to sleep contentedly at night, though he may have little of this world's goods. But the wealthy man, whose wealth is his life, lies awake at night, worrying himself to death about financial issues. He is anxious about his investments, the stock market, the interest rates, the coming budget, about unit trusts which haven't proved to be as successful as he had hoped. He's worried about his home being broken into and his wealth stolen. Every sigh of the wind, every creak of the tree, and he's up to check, is there a burglar about? He knows nothing of the sleep of contentment. A further danger of amassing wealth is seen in verse 13, where the foolishness of hoarding wealth for its own sake is scathingly exposed. Wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. The story is told of a simple man who went to a rich miser and begged to be shown his hoard of gold. Unwillingly, the miser displayed it, and the simple man said, "Thank you very much. Now I am as wealthy as you." And the miser looked at him pityingly and scathingly asked, "What makes you think that?" To which the man replied, "Well, all you do is look at it. And now I've looked at it too. So I am as wealthy as you are." This is precisely the point that is being made here, especially as verse 17 seems to suggest that the rich man economized even to the point of refusing to burn light in his home. There's something terribly sick, you know, about hoarding wealth to our own heart and harm. I suppose Howard Hughes is the classic example of that, is he not? The wealthiest man, or the one-time wealthiest man in the world, who became an eccentric recluse at the end of his life, obsessed by his own health. He lived in a darkened room. He grew his hair long. He had 2-inch-long fingernails. But as he sat there, he had this to tell himself: "I'm the wealthiest man in the world. What a great position I'm in the dark, on my own, long hair, long fingernails." Easy to be persuaded of all these dangers and to think that we are wise enough and strong enough to guard against them. Well, in verse 14 following, the preacher shows that wealth is no respecter of persons. Some people handle money with reckless abandon. They spend it as soon as they have it, or in many cases before they get it. Before the check comes in for the salary, the money is spent. They take unwise risks with their money, believing that only in this way can they make real money. And you may be thinking, "But I'm not like that. I'm smarter than that." "Fine," says the preacher. "Even though you handle your money with the greatest of care, if you live well within your means, if you're never guilty of impetuous buying or waste, if you save prudently and invest wisely, there are still some things over which you have no control." What if the company you have invested in fails overnight? What if inflation eats away at your pension fund? At the end of the day, whether you are reckless or prudent, the end result is beyond your control, because wealth is no respecter of persons. Either way, you cannot be absolutely sure that your wealth will do you any good. When the balance sheet is made up, the profit line reads zero, nil return. You're back to where you started. It's obvious, is it not, from verse 15, We brought nothing into the world and we'll take nothing out of it. We say that, but rarely do we really believe that. I wonder if some here can remember the newspaper headlines the day after Howard Hughes died. Many of them ran something like this: the richest man in the world died yesterday. And the irony of that headline was this: he was no longer the richest man in the world. He was worth less the day the paper was delivered than the newsboy who delivered it. Making wealth the reason for our existence, in the hope that it might provide us with the satisfaction for which we long, is a myth which evaporates the very day we stand before our Maker. Now, it may seem to some this morning that the preacher here has nothing good to say about wealth and would be happy for us all to wander around like penniless hermits. But we need to remind ourselves of his perspective. He has been describing life under the sun. That is his code word, you will remember, for those who live their lives without any relationship to God. His simple point is this: that wealth does not have power to bestow enjoyment on those who have it. Only God possesses that power. You see, in verses 19 and 20, the preacher admits that he knows people who have no difficulty in enjoying their wealth. What is the secret? Quite simply, it's God. He gives the gift of enjoyment, verse 19. He keeps them occupied with gladness of heart, verse 20. Now, God doesn't whimsically give this gift to some and then withhold it from others. The enjoyment of wealth is something which lies within man himself. As he opens up his life to God and seeks to live that life in the light of God's command, then enjoyment of wealth is a byproduct of that relationship. The reason why so many people find no enjoyment in their wealth is that they have made wealth their goal and not the byproduct. Wealth is their goal and their God. And wealth can be your goal whether you've got £100 in the bank or £100 million. The reason so many find no enjoyment or satisfaction in wealth is that it has become their God. No wonder it turns their hearts sour. But you see, when God reigns supreme in a person's life, then money takes its proper place and you're quite free to enjoy it. Now, this in turn, in closing, has a number of important implications for the person who's put God first. To begin with, the great goal in your life is not making money, but glorifying God. Your attitudes are also affected. The grasping hand is replaced by the open hand. There is a generosity and a cheerfulness of spirit, eager to use and share one's wealth and possessions with others. And to use our wealth in that way enriches rather than impoverishes our relationships with others. We are no longer tenaciously and anxiously grasping onto all that is ours, because we know and recognize that our God is in control of every circumstance of our lives. And He knows all the things we have need of. And so we don't need to lie awake at night, anxiously tossing and turning and wondering how secure our future is going to be. For that too is in God's good hands. We are not at the mercy of the stock market or the chancellor. We are at the mercy of the living God. This God is not sadistically determined to deny us pleasure. He simply says that the only way to find real pleasure, whether we are wealthy or not, is to find that through yielding our lives up to Him. For what shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? As we gather this morning around the Lord's table, The enjoyment of God that we can know and experience in this place is infinitely greater than anything the world has on offer. For in His presence is fullness of life. And at His right hand are pleasures forevermore. Let us approach the table not as those who have closed God out, but as those who have eagerly opened our hearts to Him.